Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Michael Adams. He teaches English language and literature at Indiana University, and he is an historian of the English language. And we'll be talking this morning about some of what you will find in his book, Slang. The subtitle of the book is The People's Poetry. It's published by the Oxford University Press. And indeed, Michael Adams says that slang is the poetry of everyday speech, deserving attention as language playing on the cusp of art. He says slang can be irritating. In fact, it's often meant to irritate, even to shock. But also, it is fun to make and it is fun to use. He says it's an expression of our innate capacity for poetry. If you're interested, of course, you can head out to the bookstore and look for the book. But here on the program, if you'd like to join in on the conversation, you can do that too by calling us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. And that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if people want to join the conversation, they can do that. The only thing we ask of callers is people just try to keep their comments and questions brief. And we ask that so we can keep moving along. But, of course, people who are listening, they're welcome to call. You are welcome to call. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Professor Adams, hello.
Hello, how are you, David?
I'm fine, thanks, and yourself?
I've got a little bit of a cold, so I'm going to apologize to everybody ahead of time if I sound a little froggy, and I hope I've taken a little cold medicine. I don't end up sounding a little vague, but I'm going to do my best over here.
Well, people listen to this show, they'd tell you that I'd sound vague every day, so they should be used to it. And I appreciate you hanging in there. Hopefully it won't be an uncomfortable experience having to sit and chat.
That would be fun.
All right. Well, you know, I suppose that the natural place to begin, as you do in your book, and I'm certain it's the kind of thing that linguists and people who study language could spend a lot of time talking about and debating, but that is the place to start, I guess, is with the definition. I would think probably maybe different people are going to have a different definition for slang, or at least if you ask people, well, what is slang? They'll have some idea, maybe not quite as refined as a linguist would. But though from person to person, that might be a little bit different. How do we even begin to get a working definition of slang?
I think you're right that it's a little different from person to person. The impression people have of slang or what counts as slang. But I think a good place to start is where some linguists would start. Some linguists would say that there's no such thing as slang and argue instead that there's a continuum of language use and that things maybe could be slangy or less slangy or more slangy on a particular occasion, but that there's no slang in the language exactly. And I take a different view of that precisely because of what you said, which is that we've all got an idea of slang, and I'm skeptical that we can all have an idea of it as language users without there being anything there. And I think that there's got to be some target or object in the language to which we're pointing when we think that we're using slang or when we identify slang in other people's language use. So I think it's an intersection of a certain social use of slang to fit in, and an aesthetic use of slang to stand out, making a statement about your style effectively in both cases, but for different purposes. That's sort of the nub of slang use, and it's true that there are words which one day in one person's mouth aren't slangy at all that can end up slangy the next day in somebody else's use. You might say, where's the slang? I guess the answer is the slang is in the use and the motives behind it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me that that one of the things at least if I was asked to define it, I guess among the things I would find to say is that we're talking about usage here that is non-standard, and that maybe if but it's possible for it to become standard, I guess, if enough people use it,
right,
then maybe then it's not slang anymore. So somehow part of the definition is that it is used by a group within the larger language group,
right,
and that it may indeed be a kind of a thing that people use to distinguish themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That it's something that we here among us use. This is our thing. Outsiders don't use this. They may not even know what it is and that's part of the deal. Perhaps it's a way of communicating in a closed sort of a sense that's exclusive to a group. That marks the difference between us and everybody else.
Yeah, absolutely. If we all use something, then it can't be slang by definition, because it isn't marking off one group against another, or it isn't exhibiting somebody's creative or aesthetic sensibility. You know, you can be a group of one and you can make up your slang word if you want to. Mm-hmm. It may not ever end up defining a group particularly, except your group of one. But yeah, if everybody uses it, then it can't be slang because it's not fulfilling either one of those purposes, either the social purpose or the creative aesthetic one.
And I suppose something could go from slang and it could become something commonly used, although it still could be non-standard or informal in that
sense. Yeah, and you're right to identify that there's a real problem of knowing where to draw the line.
Yeah.
If you're looking at the word itself, take a word like cool, which we all know and a lot of us use, and sometimes we use it in a very non-standard way. I'll give you an example that a friend of mine does all the time. If he wants to be sarcastic about what somebody else is saying, he won't just say cool. He'll say cool, right?
Yes.
So he's got to create that. He's got to put that twist on it in order to keep it as slangy as he can. But the line between slang and colloquial as a label is wavering, and I think so many people use cool today just as a sort of tag, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I'll see you at 8 o'clock. Cool, right? Let's go out to dinner next week. Cool, right? That type of usage may be slang or may not be slang. It's tough to know. So you're right. Some things end up so general in their use that it would be hard to justify calling them slang anymore.
Mm. New words are created all the time, and in part because we need them. That is, we have something that perhaps we don't have a word for it, so someone's got to make one up.
Right.
What is the, and I suppose there again is a kind of a blurry area. What's the difference between slang and something that's just a neologism?
Well, you know, if you encounter a new plant or a new animal that doesn't have a name, you've got to make up a name for it. That's the type of thing you're talking about. You know, some new phenomenon. We get new technology, and we've got to come up with names for all of the items involved in that technology, and computer speak's a good example of that. Some of that can be slangy. Some of it's actually very standard because the terms that people are using are the only terms available to describe the item, you know, like modem. I don't know where that word came from, but I'm sure that it didn't exist before there were modems, right?
Yeah.
So that's one type of word creation. There the motive is, as you suggested, linguists or historians of English would call a lexical gap. There's a hole in the vocabulary that needs to be filled, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's one type of need. But what distinguishes slang is not that it isn't needed or necessary. It's needed or necessary because of our social behavior or our aesthetic desires as we're using language. And so you could say of somebody who made up a synonym, a slang synonym for a standard term, you could say, well, that word isn't necessary. But the necessity of the word is its use in the social group in order to keep that group consolidated or to maintain it. Or the word is necessary because you have the impulse to say something clever or to do something different or to stand out in some way, and you can't stand out easily by using the standard vocabulary because that's shared by everybody, so you take your own twist on it and invent a word for that reason. So the notion of need, I think, is problematic, and some people see our needs as very narrow and strictly confined to filling those lexical gaps, and other people say, well, I need a new word right now,
yeah,
so I'll make one up.
Our guest, just real quickly, Michael Adams teaches English language and literature at Indiana University, and he is the author of the recently published book, Slang, The People's Poetry. It's published by the Oxford University Press. Questions, comments, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I guess one of the other things that is notable about slang, and it has something to do, it says something about the way we think about language, is that people continue to develop new ways of essentially saying the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you would think that, you know, if you had a perfectly good word for cool, you know, whatever your current word is, to express everything that goes with that, that one might say, well, you know, we'll just keep on using cool and it'll be cool forever. But, of course, cool is not cool forever. That's part of the deal.
Right.
But that perhaps it then though gets to this question, why is it that we feel that we have to continue to invent new ways of saying things when we already have some way to say that?
Well, here's an example that I use in the book, and it's a classic one, and one that college students, at least, usually have some experience with. We could all drink too much and become drunk, right?
Mm.
And if you've got the word drunk, why would you need another word for drunk? In any way, it's kind of a low behavior, so the less you talk about it, the better off you are, right? You don't need a special vocabulary for that. But generation after generation, people try to describe the way they're drunk differently from earlier generations or from one group to another. In a particular generation, you can try to distinguish yourself not by being drunk, but being annihilated, or being bombed, or being sloshed, or being any number of things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the use of those synonyms, if you want to look at them as synonyms, is that they are expressing not just some variety of being drunk, but they're representing the competition for being the most drunk or the most colorfully drunk or drunk in a way that belongs to your friends and you but not to your parents' generation or something like that. That's what I mean by need being a problematic notion. Your parents may not see any reason for you to get drunk, and they may not see any reason for you to use any word for it but drunk. But the truth is you've got to mark yourself off against that generation socially. So you're going to come up with a new word to describe it. You're going to take an old word that's already in the vocabulary and use it in that new way, sort of to take possession of the phenomenon.
Yeah. It's interesting here. At one page you have graphed out, in a sense, a number of these words. And one of the things about it I think is interesting is that The new words for intoxicated continue to be created, and I'm sure that they will continue to be created. And yet we have this long list of words that still are in use, and some of them actually go back
a long way. And one of the – it's not exactly a myth about slang, but one of the assumptions about slang is that it doesn't last very long. It disappears. And there are some slang terms that last for a good long time in spite of our sense that slang should be ephemeral. And you can see why it would mostly be ephemeral, because once you've got out of the social situation in which a word is useful to you for some social purpose, or once you've made it and it becomes a little bit more common and it isn't as aesthetically pleasing or exciting to you anymore, you'll move on to make some new word. You won't stick with the old word that you made because the fascination with it is done, or its social value is diminished. But some of these words do stick around a long time in spite of that, and it may, unfortunately, say something about some of our bad behaviors that some words stick around longer than others.
And I'm sure that it's also true that words are created. They're used widely. They pass out of fashion, and then later, someone somehow rediscovers them or repurposes them. I guess one of the things that I think about is the word slacker, which I believe, going back to the times of early America, was essentially a slacker was like a draft dodger,
right?
Someone who was fleeing their responsibility to serve. And that then that now we have repurposed that just in a general sort of way to talk about, somebody who's a slacker.
Right.
Doesn't everybody know what that means?
Everybody knows what that means. And dude is another example of that, a word with a good long history back into the 19th century. It started off to describe, a particular group of people dressing, acting a certain way. Now people use it just as a term of address. So it's been repurposed. in another 20 years, it's unlikely that young people will be using dude the way it's used today. Mm-hmm. That might, you know, be a word that survives, like some of those words for intoxicated, or it might pass and the young are going to come up with some other word to repurpose or something that they make up. In order to distinguish themselves from their parents, who are still walking around sort of uncomfortably saying dude all of the time. That's really great on their children, I think. And the children would have to come up with something to make it very plain that they weren't their parents.
Yeah, lots of eye rolling, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And slang is partly you might think of it as a substitute. Well, it isn't usually a substitute for the eye rolling. The eye rolling goes on, too. But, you know, you can either roll your eyes or you can do something about it. And if you are trying to mark yourself off as belonging to one generation or another, one group within a generation or another, you know, you might as well just use the language that marks your linguistic territory and not roll your eyes so much.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the basic points that you try to get across when you talk about things like this is that this illustrates something about our feeling about language, and that is we like to have fun with it.
Yeah.
It's not simply a means of communication, that people like making up words, and they like using new words, and they like saying things in ways that have not been said before, and that's just, I suppose, it's just part of our makeup.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we need to be able to make up new words and play with the language like that. We need to be able to do it in order to have a vital and interesting language, and also to enrich our experience in language. And there's a class of people, I mean a group of people, who say, oh, I used class. That was kind of a Freudian slip, I suppose. There's a class of people who, you know, are spoil sports about it, and who think that folks should avoid slang because it's not responsible or serious or standard language. But it's really an odd position to take, it seems to me, since it's natural for us to celebrate creativity. And my own democratic impulse says that it's not just credentialed poets or university professors or high-toned politicians who get to use new words or make things up or be creative, but every one of us, and we do that often in the slang that we use.
Hmm. Well, let me ask you, this is a slightly different question, but I expect that you'd have some thought about that. I'm sure that probably most of us, when we were in school and in English class, or however that was taught, the idea was gotten across to us that there are levels of use in terms of formality, and that there was the kind of way that you talk with your friends when you're hanging out. And then there's something different. You know, there was a different sort of language that you used when you went on a job interview or whether you were in a speaking in a formal situation. And then clearly and I suppose there was some sort of value attached to those things that we were given the idea that, well, it's all well and good how you're going to speak when you're hanging out with your friends, but you need to be able to function and communicate on this other level. It's very important. People will judge you by that. And after all, when you go for your job interview, you need to make the right sort of impression. And so there was this idea that there were different settings and different levels of use. Here, where I'm getting at is I think, though, that there are people who say that they've kind of been squashed together. And that is, we've lost the sense that there are these levels, and that there's a time for one and there's a time for the other, and that somehow the formal communication level has been diluted or polluted or zorched or, you know, whatever word you want. We'll go back to our list of intoxicated words, hammered or smashed, and that we've lost something.
I don't think that's true. I think that that's a myth about language. And every generation of supervisors and parents and such insist that this is true about the language of younger people particularly, but the society as a whole, because of the effect of younger people on it. You know, I think this is just being grouchy about getting old in part. But maybe a natural attitude for people who are seeing the world change out from under them to have. I suppose that language may be more informal now in some settings than it was a few decades ago. I'm not sure that I think that that's a bad thing. I don't talk about this much in the book. I don't talk about it this way, but when you go into a job interview, you're in a social setting, and you're using your language in order to demonstrate something about yourself socially in the same way that you would in conversation with your friends. And you're right. when we're in the group with our friends and we understand what defines that group, and part of what defines it is language, and part of how we prove that we know the definition is by using the language, that's where we're likely to use slang, and that's where it's appropriate because it serves those purposes. When we're in the job interview, we're still performing, in a sense, with a social purpose, and that's to get that job and to impress the person on the other side of the table. You could argue that what you're really showing is that you're going to cleave to a standard or toe a line or behave in a way that's unnatural to you because that's what makes you subordinate to the employer. The employer sets the terms or draws the line, and you've got to be able to know how to identify that line and to toe it so that you're agreeing essentially then in that speech situation that that you're not the one who's making the rules, but somebody else is making the rules. That's not the time to be maximally creative with your language or to say funny or nasty things or raunchy or hip things or things that the person who's interviewing you wouldn't understand because they belong to another group you belong to, which isn't the group of people who are being employed in a certain sector of the economy, but the group of friends back home watching television or whatever. So there's a good reason maybe to have those levels. The good reason isn't necessarily necessary, but it's one that, you know, I think we just naturally as human beings want to stratify things at times or to operate according to that hierarchy, and speech is going to be one of the ways that we create the hierarchy and respond to the hierarchy of who's in charge and who isn't.
We're about midway through this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Michael Adams. He is on the faculty at Indiana University. He teaches English language and literature there. He is an historian of English language, and one of the things he's particularly interested in is the history and practice of dictionary making. His book that we've mentioned is Slang, the People's Poetry, and it is published by the Oxford University Press. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We're talking a little bit earlier about the business of trying to come up with a definition of slang, and I suppose one way that you could do that is by talking about, generally speaking, who it is that is the creator of slang. And it seems to be sort of the activity of marginalized groups in the sense. I'm guessing that probably most of the slang we have comes from young people and also perhaps of minority groups within society. And it's part of this business of forging identity, I think, and saying this is us, this is who we are. We're different from everybody else.
Yeah.
And we even have our own language to prove that.
Right, and you can peeve people with it, you know. You can, and you don't have to be violent or argumentative, or you don't really have to put yourself very far out on the line in order to prove the point that you're different and you're not necessarily agreeing with everything the establishment wants you to agree with. And it's naturally rebellious language, and probably does belong to these groups, as you say, who feel that they're marginalized. But as I say in the book, I think to one degree or another, we all think that we're marginalized, you know, and we probably have some right to believe that, at least in one sector of our experience. You know, we're not always in the same group or doing the same activity or playing the same role socially. So as you move from group to group in your everyday work and life, sometimes you're the marginalized person either within that group or by virtue of being in that group, and sometimes you're not. You know, if you're I'm using a stereotype here advisedly. I don't mean anything judgmental by it, really. But if you're a geeky video game player in your private life, but you're in charge of people at work in another setting, you can be the voice of authority in one case, and you can feel yourself quite marginalized and adopt gaming language for the fun of it, for the creativity of it, because it's connected to the experience of the games, because those games have languages sometimes that you get sucked into. So you're really living in two linguistic worlds, depending on the setting. And we all know what it's like to be a little bit on the margin, even if not all of us know exactly what it's like to be in the mainstream.
Hmm. Are there any, you know, can one say anything about how slang is created? Is it something that ends up being, say, it's words that are made out of whole cloth, words that truly didn't exist? Or is this a matter of taking maybe something that does exist or pieces that do exist and putting them together in a new way or assigning a new meaning to them?
Yeah. And truthfully, there's very little English that gets made from whole cloth.
Hmm.
I mean, almost every word that gets made, there are some exceptions, is borrowed from another language or borrowed from another part of the vocabulary and then shifted to a different use or repurposed, as you were saying earlier, or words are clipped, as linguists would say, broken up into pieces according to certain rules, usually, that tell you where you can break a word up into parts and then recombined. That's how you get words like spork for a utensil that's both a spoon and a fork. And it's where you get a word that I've got in the book, lexifabricography, which is lexicography of made-up words, which is where the fabra comes in. And that part is stuck into the middle of lexicography, you know, clipped from another word. So usually, it doesn't have to be slang. What's true of the whole language is true of slang in this case. Usually, we recombine parts. We don't make things up.
As far as we know, and I guess as far back as we would know, I suppose, is as far back as we have things written down. Have people always done this?
Have people always done slang?
Have people always engaged in the making of slang?
We don't really know, because the records of earlier language are so sparse sometimes, and the records that we have are usually, not always, but usually learned in some way. We've got lots of medieval English texts that have to do with religion, saints' lives, and directions on how people should behave within the priesthood, and sample sermons or homilies that priests can use. And these aren't the places where you expect slang to come up. So we kind of have to depend on the notion of a slang impulse to project backward and believe that people were using very informal language for social and aesthetic reasons that we don't have a record of today, even if they were recorded at the time. We may just have lost the manuscripts in which the evidence could be found. Mm. But we do have examples, for instance, in Middle English around Chaucer's time of bits of slang. Some of these are a little colorful and probably not appropriate for a radio program, although I think they're all legal. But even the use of man, you know, the way that we say, hey, man, mm-hmm. you know, I love you or something like that.
I love you, man.
That man, that colloquial term of address, that's there in the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
A very long-lived item of slang. But we've got little slivers of evidence like that suggest that people were using language much as we use it today. We just don't have a very complete record of informal English.
Well, it would seem to be a more reasonable thing to suggest that people were doing it, maybe going back to when we started to have language, a more reasonable thing to suggest that than rather than just one day it just started out of nowhere.
Yeah, exactly. And as I argue in the book, it's this playfulness with language serves a linguistic purpose, which is to keep us practiced in the potential of language by allowing us to test its boundaries a little bit all of the time. And so we don't know when humans developed that ability to test the boundaries of their own language with non-standard language, but it certainly didn't happen in 1300 or 1200 or 1100 or even 1000 BC, but sometime before that, where we've got no record of language at all. And we know that Latin authors, you know, use slang sometimes. So there's a record that back in the history it was there. It's just not a very full record. And it would be tough to make a dictionary of English slang, for instance, before the year 1500. That would be a really short dictionary on the basis of the evidence we've got.
All right, let's talk with someone. Hear a caller on a cell phone, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Great topic today. I'm actually a linguist at the University of Illinois and just had a class last night in which my students and I were talking about slang and where it comes from. And so a lot of my students are current English teachers or teachers in the school system here. And one thing that I tried to get across was a great deal of slang comes from filling semantic holes in the language. So any particular language doesn't have a word for every possible thing that one might experience in the kind of infinite range of human experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so we you know compared some common slang, like, well, things that are labeled as slang, like bling, for example. How is that different from jewelry? Well, in fact, there are quite distinct differences. So
right.
Most languages, in fact, don't have two words that mean exactly the same thing.
Right, right.
And so these linguistic innovations that tend to be made by the young and other groups are seeking to fill semantic voids in the language that you know, any human language has, in fact, plenty of semantic voids that there hasn't, no one's kind of come up with a label. And as you said, you know, linguistic borrowings from other languages are big. Germanic languages like English, as you said, tend to put compound words or clip words or blend words. Other languages have other means by which they kind of coin words. So it was we had quite a nice discussion on which is exactly your point, the generativity and the productivity and the creativity of lexical kind of coinage.
Yeah, and I like the fact that you used the S word, though I wasn't using it, because semantic is such a complicated notion in a way. I mean, we're thinking of where the gap is that we're trying to fill and how we fill the meaning gap, right?
Right.
And
right.
It's not just that there isn't a word that means something in the way that a dictionary defines it. When you're in a particular setting trying to communicate a particular thing, and that thing could be not just jewelry, but an attitude toward jewelry, right?
Right.
And that's part of the meaning, too. So you've got to come up with a new word, like bling, in order to convey the whole meaning, not just the meaning that we attach to the word jewelry, because jewelry just isn't adequate to convey all that meaning. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and it's fun. There's a book, and the title has escaped me right now, but it's a collection of words from other languages that we don't have words for in English, like... One of my favorites is po'o, which is Hawaiian for to scratch your head to help you remember what it is you were thinking of.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's another thing that slang helps us to accomplish, because we've got a way of saying, what was the phrase again? Something you need to remember, but you...
But, yes, yeah, so just the act of scratching your head to help you remember something.
Yeah, well, I can say, you know, well, I was scratching my head to help me remember something.
Right,
but it would really be convenient if I had a word for
you
that.
Had a word for that, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
I don't need to have a word for that in some strict lexical sense, because I can string all those other words together into that long phrase and convey something like the meaning. But if I could say it more quickly and conveniently, sometimes that's the motive for new word creation, and it's sometimes the motive for slang.
Exactly, exactly. Jeffrey Eugenides, the author of Middlesex and Suicides, said he once in an interview I read had a nice list of things that he thought English should have words for, like the intimations of mortality brought about by aging relatives.
Yeah.
And the joy that one experiences when you find you've got a hotel room with a minibar.
You know, this is not illegitimate to write down a list of words that you or a list of meanings that you think ought to have words for them. Barbara Walrath, for a long time in The Atlantic, has done a column called Word Fugitives, where she has readers write in with proposals about these words that you would need. But what fascinates me about slang as a function in human language is that it isn't writerly like that or deliberate
like that.
There's nothing wrong with the writerly or deliberate, but we get faced with this need to have a word suddenly,
right?
And we come up with it on the fly, and it is, to me, just a wondrous human capability to be able to do that. And that's why I think it's that poetic impulse. It's not my idea that it is. Walt Whitman had the same idea, that slang is, you know, the froth and the speck of the language, some of which settles into the language, but most of which just flies away, right, because it's there for the moment.
Exactly.
But, you know, we live in the moment. So writers can sit down and make their list of desiderata. There's nothing wrong with that. But most of us every day are coming up with something, maybe just one thing, interesting in our speech. And that's part of what it means to be human. It's really a
exactly.
wonderful thing.
Exactly. And I think that my students, we had kind of fun last night thinking about all the creativity that it entails rather than just looking at it as if it were substandard somehow.
Yeah, and it's so hard for teachers because teachers operate by rules, too. And they've got tests that they've got to prepare students for more now than ever that don't have anything to do with slang. And how you foster creativity and help people to appreciate their linguistic power on the one hand while getting them to understand what the social rules for standard written English are, that's a really difficult balance. And I admire any teacher whose students leave the classroom knowing how to write really fluent sentences, but doesn't, in the course of that, accidentally discourage them from being creative.
Right. Well, thanks very much
for
the great show. I appreciate it.
Well,
yeah,
thanks
it was
for
great to talk to you.
And just, again, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, but I think something here that's emerged in your conversation with the caller that strikes me now and I hadn't really thought about before, and it increases my appreciation for slang, and that is the idea that it is not simply just a word for something we already have a word for. That why, perhaps the reason that we use it, that we like it, that we create it, is that slang words can have a very can be very rich in connotation.
Mm-hmm.
It can have all sorts of meanings and images attached to
yeah.
them, and that's why one of the reasons that they're so good. And again, that maybe gets back to this, you know, why is it we don't just have one word for everything? Well, we got lots of ways of saying the same thing, and but then again, we're not always saying the same thing.
I mean, you could be fussy and probably overly theoretical about it, and say, no speech situation is the same as any other speech situation,
sure.
and so meaning is always a little different. That's basically true. So when we're challenged to say something we haven't felt the need to say before, something good can come out of that. Some little bit of slang, some froth or speck that probably will fly away and nobody else will ever pay any attention to. But for that moment, that was exactly the right thing for you to say.
Yeah. Our guest, Michael Adams, is assistant professor in the Department of English at Indiana University. He's an historian of English language and is very much interested also in dictionary making. His book, if you'd like to read it, is Slang, the People's Poetry, and it's published by the Oxford University Press. We have another caller, and
okay.
let us talk with this person here, line number two in Urbana. Anna. Hello.
Hi. It strikes me that much of what you're saying about slang and young people also applies to jargon and academic papers and lectures.
Mm-hmm.
Except perhaps the artistic.
I think that you have put your finger on something interesting and important. I try to draw the distinction in the book between jargon and slang as the difference between language of work and language of being. So when somebody is a server in a restaurant doing a particular job, certainly there's a social group of servers there, and they develop their own language for dealing with the work they have to do. That's a little bit different from everyday slang, probably. And I think the reason that the academic discourse example is so good is it's not clear always that that's serving the purposes of work so much as it's serving the social need of academics to belong to a group that knows that language, right? And other people don't know that language. And so it marks the group of academics in question off from the rest of the world of speakers. And I sometimes suspect when people are using jargon, that's when my necessary flag rises a little bit. And I say, I wonder if that's necessary in the sense that you couldn't do this thinking well without those words, or whether people want to develop the vocabulary to be part of the group of people who discuss this subject or pursue this field. Obviously, in some cases, in the physical sciences and such, there's going to be a lot of jargon that's necessary because it's necessary for naming things. Maybe a little bit less true in the humanities and its jargon.
Yep.
Yep, does that sound right?
Sure.
You know, sometimes you think that you're reading the material of a clique.
Right.
Like these people were a high school group that you didn't fit into either, and you read the books with the jargon in it, and you think, if I'm going to be part of this, I'm going to have to learn this jargon, and arguably that's what the jargon is for, is to draw that line, and you can take that as an invitation or you can take that as a barrier.
Yeah, I think that's why a lot of PhD theses never actually get published.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I had a student one time tell a really interesting story. I was teaching at Duke University, and she was this fantastic mathematics student. She was so good. Every mathematics student at Duke was given a number, you know, humorously and appropriately. And the very best mathematics students' numbers were retired when they graduated. And hers was retired while I was there. She was that good. And she'd gone off to give her first paper at a conference as a senior undergraduate, right? And she gave this paper that apparently was brilliant. And a fellow, an experienced, maybe retired fellow, came up to her after the paper she gave, and he said, "You know what?" He said, "That was really brilliant. But you've got to learn how to talk the talk until you get tenure. And then you can put things as plainly and sensibly as you want to. But until then, you're going to have to prove that you belong in this group." And that's exactly the sort of thing we're talking about.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the call. We have maybe about 6 or 7 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Michael Adams. Questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I'll ask you, because I know from reading your background is that you're someone who part of your professional interest is in dictionaries and in mm-hmm. making dictionaries. And I'm sure that one could, and people have, made slang dictionaries.
Yes.
And that in a sense, I'm sure also they have a limited shelf life. At least what happens is that you could say this is a snapshot of mm-hmm. a particular time,
yeah.
And it maybe tell you something about that time, but that it's I can't guarantee you that the words that are in this dictionary will be used forever.
Right, that's true. There are, there is one project underway. I wish it could get the funding to move along a little faster, called the Historical Dictionary of American Slang, which is edited by Jonathan Leiter, and it is a wonderful dictionary that you could say is the OED of American slang. And it treats slang that way, and it comes up pretty much to the present day. And a dictionary like that is very, very durable once it's finished, in the way that the Oxford English Dictionary is durable. The slang dictionary is a wonderful opportunity for the lexicographer to work on subsequent editions. I mean, that's the answer to your question, I think, is that, and another one that's just come out that's really great, Tom Dalzell, who is actually, he's a labor lawyer, I believe, not an academic, but he and Terry Victor did a great dictionary called the New Partridge Dictionary of Slang and Unconventional English, which doesn't really bear much resemblance to the classic after which it's named. That is in two volumes, British, U.S., Canadian, everything, and, you know, you're right. 20 years from now, in order to be current, they would have to go back into that dictionary, probably pull some things out to make some space, and then get the new slang in.
Well, that's, I suppose, with any dictionary, though, that's they're never truly fixed, even at what is represented to be a standard dictionary. Periodically, they have to be overhauled. And if you're talking about something that is actually going to exist on paper and is going to be of a reasonable size, periodically you have to go through and you have to say, all right, there's some things here that we're going to take out because we know there are some new things we want to put in.
Yeah,
so it's never.
You've identified all of the constraints there correctly, because anybody who has a dictionary knows that they want more words in it, but they don't want it to be any bigger, and they don't want the print to be any smaller, and they don't want the paper to be any thinner. And so you do have to take stuff out if you're going to add stuff. And truthfully, it's not just that periodically dictionaries have to be updated. It might surprise some listeners to hear this, but the Merriam-Webster's dictionaries or the American Heritage dictionaries or the New World dictionaries are continually revised, and from printing to printing will include new words and take other words out. So if you have the Webster, Merriam-Webster's 11th Collegiate Dictionary 11th edition from the year that it was published, 2 years later, you'll still be in the 11th edition. But the version that's printed that year will have some changes in it that will reflect words that they're entering for the first time and probably words they're taking out because they have to make room for the new words that look like they deserve that attention or treatment. Mm-hmm.
We have a caller here, at least one more I want to accommodate before we end up out of time. Someone in Indiana, Mill Creek Valley, Indiana, line number 4, toll-free line right here. Hello.
Yeah. An interesting phenomenon, as I said here. I'm listening to you on the phone and listening on the radio, and the two broadcasts are not right together. There's a difference. There's a lot of time lapse here. The origin of words and the origin of people's names has always been fascinating to me. And
mm-hmm.
dictionaries are the same way. And the changing of the language, as Mr. Inge mentioned, changing when I was in high school 60 years ago, we used the word neat.
Uh-huh.
And now it's cool.
Uh-huh.
Although about 3 years ago, I heard neat starting to come back.
Yes.
Cool, however, is being edged out to some extent by sweet.
Yes.
And I think that's interesting, the way the language changes all the time.
Yeah. And cool and neat and sweet are old words in English.
Well, yeah.
But as David was saying, they've been repurposed for this slang meaning.
Oh, yeah.
And if you're a young person, you can't use the language of older people in order to sound cool, because older people, by definition, aren't cool. We may think that we're cool, but young people often don't think that we're all that cool. Another one that's come to my attention recently that you'll appreciate is dig it, dig, to dig. And 3 or 4 years ago, I heard a 9 or 10-year-old, ask me the question, "Can you dig it?"
Oh boy!
It was the funniest thing. I had to hold myself back from laughing, because I didn't want to seem rude to this girl. But that, of course, was something I would have expected to hear from teenagers when I was a child back in the 60s, not from a 9-year-old in 2004 or 2005. So you're right, those words get recycled in that way all the time.
Yeah, I have a question for you here. And I guess in the 1700s, probably before that, 1600s, 1800s, the word can't was used, as you know,
mm-hmm.
for criminal slang.
Yes.
And it seems to me that criminal slang must be one of the most prolific that there is. I can only think of gat, rod, and heater instead of a gun. But
right.
New terms, you see them in the newspapers, and they have to have an explanation for what they mean sometimes.
Sure. One of the things I talk about in the book and illustrate in the book is the proliferation of terms for the recreational drug MDMA, which most people refer to as ecstasy. But there are, in fact, probably hundreds of names for particular varieties of this, and one of the reasons there are so many names is so that people can talk about it without anybody knowing what they're talking about. And many of them are euphemisms, and that all would count as a type of criminal slang, I suppose, at least as far as the drug dealers are concerned, if not the drug users.
I think that's what the cant was for, wasn't it, to
confuse
people?
Yep, to hide things, yep.
Did you write about that to some extent?
I do to some extent, yeah, but because it's meant to hide things, and we're not always trying to hide things when we're speaking slang, but we're doing other social and aesthetic business, while I talk about it, I don't focus on it, really.
Yeah, okay, well, thanks.
Thank you.
Boy, doesn't Mr. Inge do a good job of holding the program together? Oh, he's smooth, I tell you.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
I listen to him fairly often. He's good. He's cool, man.
Yeah. Oh, all right. I'll take that as a compliment. Thank you very much. We have a couple of minutes left here. I want to go back to something just real quick that I thought was really interesting, and I wrote it down after you said it, talking about how with language, we're always testing the boundaries of the language, and that maybe making up new words and finding new ways to use existing words is part of that, that's just something that we do. And that then causes me to think or to raise the question, if language could not evolve? If it didn't have the ability to evolve, would we have been able to evolve?
That's too big a question. We don't know the answer to that question any more than we know 100% about whether we would have evolved. Well, we wouldn't have evolved maybe in the way that we have evolved, but there are all kinds of physical facts about our evolution that we, you know, we can't really decide which is the chicken and which is the egg. Our brains, human beings' brains, got really big at one point. Did they get big because we were developing language? Was language something that developed because we had big brains? What other purposes did big brains have that might have been competing with language? How did language become recognized by early humans as a very efficient and effective way of holding groups together, having societies with all of their efficiency in helping maintain, you know, people, allowing them to live and survive and live interesting and productive lives? I mean, I don't know, and I don't think that anybody really does know yet.
But to me, I guess the important idea that I come away with is the idea that it's a good thing that language is not static, that it doesn't stay the same, and that we might have reason to worry if someday it's stopped changing.
Yeah, I mean, I always hesitate to compare language with the biological system, but you recognize pretty quickly the analogy between just the variety of, you know, human genetic variety. I mean, we know that we can't all have exactly the same DNA. We can't survive as a species that way. We depend on a lot of variety in order to make the existence and the progress of the species possible. And I suppose one could say of language the same thing. If we all spoke the same language, which for some people is a utopian ideal, it wouldn't really reflect the natural social differences among us. And, you know, I don't think that we all want to be the same. Hmm.
There, we'll have to leave it. The book, if you'd like to read it, is Slang, The People's Poetry. It's published by the Oxford University Press by our guest, Michael Adams. He teaches English language and literature at Indiana University. And Professor Adams, thanks very much.
It has been a great pleasure, David. Thank you for having me.